Of all the saints we remember during the Advent season, two are women. Any idea who they are? Well, of course, the first to come to mind is the Virgin Mary, whose Feast of the Immaculate Conception falls on December 8th. The second is the lesser known but much loved Saint Lucy, celebrated December 13th. Father Bernard O'Connor of the Congregation for Eastern Churches explained to me the impact of women like these on the church and the faithful.
When we look at the canon of the Mass, and especially look at the development of the Eucharistic canon, we see references to women regularly. Agatha, we call Agnes. Various women's names appear regularly. In feast days that are familiar to the Latin Christians, you see women's names continually, and these have historic precedent, especially when you think of saints like Cecilia, though she's not commemorated during Advent, but known from the early church. Saint Lucy, who we're going to speak about today, was very, very well known in the earliest years of the church, before even our liturgy and liturgical calendar had developed as it has today. So the mission of women, the vitality of the contribution of women, the positive energizing of faith communities by women is all through Catholic history. Very appropriate for Lent, because if we're welcoming a Christ to come, his return, we have to recognize where Christ has already come, and that is in the heart and witness of Christian women.
One of the women, you just mentioned her, that we're speaking about today is Saint Lucy, Santa Lucia.
Santa Lucia. If I could sing, I'd hum, at least hum a few birds.
Tell us a little bit more about her. She was one of the early Christian martyrs, wasn't she?
In fact, she was probably born about the year 283. And so in the 3rd century, well known. And before her death, she was very young when she was martyred, probably somewhere around 303. 52 years before, we had already had other great martyr, female martyr, well known, Saint Agatha. And again, it was already becoming important to the Christian community, not only to see where women have given themselves and have sacrificed themselves all through their lives and then in death, but to recognize that that became their call. So what we call the cult of the martyrs was already taking a prominent feature in ordinary Christian life. People were wanting to examine their lives. They were wanting to make pilgrimages to their tomb. They were wanting to have relics to be part of the structure of their whole civic communities as well. They were so wanting the spirit of this martyr, of this saint, to infuse their daily existence that they went to great ends to preserve even a piece of bone.
Well, in that period, it was the time of the persecution by the Romans against the small but growing Christian community all throughout the Roman Empire. And Lucia was actually from Syracuse.
From Syracuse, yes.
Syracuse. In southern Italy.
With a governor who took his responsibilities to the Roman authorities very serious. I think it's pronounced Passatius. Forgive me, I don't think that's pronounced correctly. But in any event, a Roman governor of Syria. And this is what really led to her martyrdom.
Tell us about the circumstances of her martyrdom.
Well, it's very, very interesting. This lady was born of a very rich and noble family. And a lesson by there we learn, by the way, she was willing from her earliest years to want to put the resources of that family, to surrender them completely as charity for the poor. Her mother, very fascinating woman, had developed an illness, was not quite as disposed to the completeness of her daughter's desire to consecrate her life religiously, but the mother develops an illness. She was persuaded by her daughter, Lucia, go to the tomb of Saint Agatha, pray for a miracle. We will help you in that prayer process. Mother was cured. Mother takes on a whole new outlook. Now, she still wanted her daughter to marry, and the daughter was quite unwillingly betrothed to a young man. And the young man in question thought, oh, well, now, if she were known to be Christian because we're betrothed and she were to be executed, well, I'm her betrothed, I'm her inheritor of all the wealth that the church would normally get. So therefore, he denounces her to the governor, whose name I've just so poorly pronounced. The governor of Sicily then is required to begin a process of interrogation. The process determines, yes, indeed, I'm a Christian. No, I will not forsake the faith. And it left him wondering, now what are we going to do here? Normally the immediate punishment of a woman who has been accused of Christianity at the time was to force them to be prostitutes. Well, this didn't quite work. She said, absolutely, I will not renounce. You can do whatever you want with my body. Nothing is going to happen here. And she basically ridiculed him even for considering that. And he felt so annoyed, he then was going to have her executed by fire. Well, the fire and the logs and everything put around her wouldn't burn, no matter what they tried to do. So then he said, well, a sword will work. And that eventually is how her life was taken. And there's a wonderful lesson here that Christians today in Advent, I think, can really benefit from hearing. There were two attempts to kill the poor woman. They did not succeed. On the third one, she dies. And it reminds me of St. Paul writing about his own trials and tribulations, some of which he was certainly saved from, but others he was not. And for us who are inclined to think in our society that God will automatically rescue us, it's like if I put money in a machine expecting a candy bar. I put in my money, I get the candy bar. We think if I profess belief, if I go to Mass, well, then everything is going to turn out lovely. Her life, like that of Paul, proves that there comes a moment in which basically, fundamentally, we can't expect to do anything other than to confide ourselves to the Lord in such a way that He is free to do with us what He will, even if that includes at that moment not being spared death. We offer our totality, life and death, to Him in the Christian commitment.
Now, Saint Lucy, Santa Lucia, is also remembered for the symbol of light. Many people, especially in Northern Europe, celebrate Santa Lucia with candle lights, and it's a wonderful image at Christmas time, isn't it?
I think it's a very beautiful image. And I've seen, for example, in the case of the Scandinavian countries, where women will wear little crowns made of candles
exactly.
Mm-hmm. On St. Lucia Day. But the message beneath the light is not only that this woman who gave her life for the light of the world, Christ, and she gave her life for the light within herself of His Spirit that she so responded to seek to unite herself to God. But there's something about candles that very much represents her martyrdom, as all martyrs. A candle, when it is lit, ultimately will die by exhausting itself. It gives so completely, there'll be nothing left after a short period of time. So the candle becomes as important a symbol as the light. Mm. Because the candle is saying, I give my all till there's nothing left in the service of the one who is my light. The light has the right to claim my all.
And another woman who gave her all was, of course, Mary, Christ's mother. Tell us, why do we remember her so especially during this Advent period?
When we celebrate Advent, of course, what we're celebrating again is the return of Christ, a Christ who in his earthly life certainly gave his all, paralleling hers. Through our tradition, our Blessed Mother has continually been acknowledged as the new Eve, just as Christ is the new Adam. And so therefore it becomes extremely significant to see that a sinless Eve, who unfortunately didn't remain so, becomes then the promise of a Redeemer. Now a sinless new Eve brings forth the Redeemer. And so all through Christian history, we have this wonderful discussion culminating in what's called a dogma, a definitive statement of faith in 1854, that is saying this is the nature of the new Eve, to continually and always bring forth for humanity the new Adam, the Redeemer. And it is his redemption, which we're saying in Advent, is going to be culminated in his return. But it began in hers.
With the Immaculate Conception.
With the Immaculate Conception.
Which the Church celebrates on December
8th. And do you notice, Tracy, it's very interesting, on December 9th, we celebrate the Feast of St. Juan Diego, who was the recipient of the Revelation of Guadalupe. And
sure.
We celebrate Guadalupe immediately following the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. And science today is telling us something remarkable about the cloth associated with Guadalupe. It shows, a pregnant woman, she's pregnant, continually giving birth to the Redeemer. And it shows also, so modern scientific analysis is saying, an extraordinary image in the eyes, in proper optical and scientific categories, the image of Juan Diego, who was being looked at by the woman of the Tilma. And it's so beautiful to say Immaculate Conception is not a distant dogma. Immaculate Conception, the mission of Mary is what's being commemorated, reaches out even to such people as Juan Diego, commemorated the next day. And even as her mission continues for all of us, the pregnant woman on the cloth of Guadalupe, it all connects in a magnificent way, liturgically in our calendar, to express the mission of a mother. A mother who loves her children and is very close to all of us.
Of course, you were just touching on it, but it's December 25th, which we in the Catholic Church celebrate the birth of the Christ child. And Mary, who brought him into this world, you mentioned this importance of a mother for all of us. At this time of Advent, what should we be reflecting on?
I think the fact that all of us, whether we're actually married, whether we're a parent, we have a parental sense within us, because a parent says, I want to form and guide and shape and nourish and defend my children. But when you stop and think of it, isn't that the role of all Christians with relationship to every other human being with whom we encounter? And the birth of Christ, I think, is showing such a remarkable variety of responses. From, you know, the poor Christ child, literally poor, born in a stable, born amid animals, born with straw for his mattress, in a home that really wasn't his home. It belonged to cats, to cows and sheep and horses and what have you. There's a lesson there that we too experience all kinds of poverties, maybe not from our birth. We talked about St. Lucy, born of noble parentage, but very really through our lives, we're afflicted and we're conflicted. Our Blessed Mother knew that. At the time of the Nativity, during her pregnancy, at the time of her Immaculate Conception, her parents would have had all the tribulations proper to their category of class and society and what have you. So she's very familiar with this range of human difficulties. And her son is born into the midst of that. That identifies him with us, but it also identifies her with us.
And she gives us this motherly courage.
Very, very much. There's a wonderful statement. I've always been very, very fond of it from the book of Genesis. And it's with reference to the old Eve. And the old Eve is told by God that as a result of the disobedience of she and Adam, that there would be enmity between he and the woman, referring to the serpent. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, she shall crush your head and you shall lie in wait for his heel. And this is what we call the proto-evangelium, the earliest sense of the real gospel, that a redeemer would come forth out of that disobedience. But what I really like about it, the word in Hebrew apparently, for he shall crush your head, or as sometimes she shall crush your head, the serpent is being addressed, this is his punishment. And that we never know, does it mean he or does it mean she? If it means he, then we can anticipate Christ. And if it's she, obviously, it's the vocation of Mary. The enmity is definitely with her and the serpent. They're always at odds. Goodness is always challenged. But I'm delighted when I see the he, she, so confusing even to the language that biblical scholars don't know. Isn't it amazing to think that all through history, the role of the Blessed Mother is so entwined and just merged with the role of Christ that they're always inseparable in intent and desire and will, right from the language of Genesis to every apparition such as Lourdes that preceded the dogma. Everyone shows this wonderful association in every respect of the he, Christ, of the she, his mother.
Well, that's certainly something to reflect on this Christmas season, so thank you so much again,
You are
Father.
Most welcome. My joy to be here.
And a very warm thanks there to Father Bernard O'Connor, an official with the Congregation for Eastern Churches.